I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello again, everybody, and thank you for joining us on this, the latest Motorsport Magazine podcast from London. And this one is a cracker. We have a special guest with us today, back by popular demand, actually, judging by the number of questions that have been sent in for Pat Simmons. A driving force, of course, behind Schumacher's championship at Benetton, Alonso's championship at Renault, and now a consultant for the Marussia Grand Prix team. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you very much.
That was all correct, wasn't it?
It was.
Oh, yes. Good. Sometimes,
and luckily, you didn't mention it goes back a lot further than that as well.
Yes. Sometimes I have to ask the Roebuck, who is also here. Nigel, our Grand Prix correspondent and editor-in-chief. And also here is, for the first time, welcome Simon Aaron, our features editor, who's come in off the road to join us on the magazine. Welcome, Simon.
Thanks, Rob.
Okay, Pat, let's start by asking a really simple, straightforward question to which you will have the answer. Who is going to win the Australian Grand Prix in 10 days' time?
Well, that's probably the least straightforward question you could ever ask me. And naturally, I don't have the answer. But, you know, it's really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, we go through this sort of false dawn of winter testing. And we all charge around and we moan about everything. You know, tyres are no good, the track's too cold, it's too wet, it's too hot, it's too black, it's too white, I don't know. And we do the best we can, obviously, to make our cars reliable, competitive, raceable, all these sort of things. And we really are working flat out. You know, people in Formula One don't know any other way of working. We're always working flat out. And no matter where we might be in the pecking order, we're just trying to go faster. It's our reason for existence. And therefore, it really doesn't matter what anyone else is doing. It doesn't matter whether we're at the front or the back. We're still going to work as hard. So, you know, why should we bother about who's quick and who isn't? But, you know, human nature being what it is, and us all being competitive people, we spend ages trying to analyse what's going on. I mean, we can make total fools of ourselves because we all try and bluff each other. And it's like a sort of huge game of chess, really, I think.
Yeah.
But I think we're starting to see a bit of a picture from the three tests. And so I will sort of have a bit of a go at estimating where I think people are. Now, if you look at the bare facts, I think most people say, well, Mercedes is looking great. Red Bull don't look quite so hot. And of course, I think that's probably entirely incorrect because Red Bull are the masters of disguising their pace. And when we do our analysis, of course, one of the things we're trying to do is to figure out how much fuel is in the car and therefore, you know, how quick they can go and everything. And we've now got to the point where we assume that no matter what, the Red Bull is quick. And therefore, we sort of say, well, okay, how much fuel would they have been running to be quick?
Yeah.
And so therefore, I was still sort of putting them at the front. But there is no doubt that the Mercedes is fast. Now, I think that those were out and out, I won't say qualifying laps, but pretty low fuel that both Rosberg and Hamilton did. But nevertheless, I think they look good. But, you know, I think Ferrari are right there. And surprisingly, I'm not sure that McLaren are. I see McLaren being a little bit off the pace at the moment, in spite of a few days when they've hit the headlines with the fastest time. My estimate at the moment is they're probably anything up to sort of 1.5% off the pace.
Wow. Damn, that's quite a long way, isn't it?
Of course, I may be wrong.
Yes. Okay.
Do you think Ferrari are looking that good, Pat?
Yeah, I do. I think both Alonso and Massa, actually, both on the long runs and the qualifying laps, for want of a better word, because what we tend to do is we look at when they're doing a really quick lap, and okay, that can be anything from sort of 10 to 30 kilograms of fuel, even 40 kilograms of fuel if they want to hide what they're doing. And from that, we try and estimate the, and of course you always see it's one lap, or it might be one quick lap followed by a couple of slow laps, but you know that's running, you know, engine modes that are at the limit, it's running DRS where allowed, etc. But then we also look at the long run pace, where the engines will be turned down a little bit. Generally speaking, you don't use DRS during the long run simulations, and we try and estimate race pace from that. And in both cases, in my view, or I should say our view, because it's cleverer people than me who do all the analysis. Ferrari are looking right there, I think.
I mean, in real terms, Pat, when you're running around in Barcelona in January, February, and the track temperature is 7, 8, 9 degrees or whatever, and the next major test for you is, you know, Australia, where the ambient's going to be 30, and then Malaysia, where the track temperature might be 45. I mean, how easy is it for you to correlate what you get from the winter tests in cold Europe and make it work in the tropical climate?
It's incredibly difficult. And, you know, we do three tests before the start of the season. And generally speaking, the way you approach these days is that you try and leave the designers and the aerodynamicists as long as you possibly can to do all the performant parts of the car. And so you generally won't see those until the last test anyway. So first two tests, concentration really is on reliability, it's on systems, it's on procedures, it's making sure everything's good. In our case, Marussia, new drivers, so a lot of training to do for them. So you're not too worried about the fact that the tyres aren't behaving, as they will do, I hope, in Melbourne. But by the time you get to the last test, yeah, you're wanting to find out, you know, how to set your car up, find the sweet spot, really, you know, see how to get the performance out of it. And I have to say, last week in Barcelona, it was pretty damn difficult, because it really was a struggle to get the tyres to last any time at all. We were getting, even when we were trying to do the sort of qualifying type simulations, we're getting a lot of graining on the front tyres, and if we tried to do a few more laps, the rears would start to grain. And it was very difficult to work like that, and it all looked a bit disastrous. But if you think back to 2011, when Pirelli first came along, I remember I was sort of a little bit more on the periphery of things then, but I remember everyone saying, well, you know, it's going to be 5 stops in Melbourne, and, you know, can we do 3 stops, or is that too risky? And of course, it panned out as a race where some people did 1 stop, majority did 2, no problems. So, you know, I'm not really don't want to paint a picture of doom at the moment. I think things will be back to normal. To answer your question, it's difficult, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be like that race time.
Pat, this latest generation of Pirellis, and every year there's the problem with testing in low temperatures and where are we? Have they been more of a problem this year than you've encountered in the past?
From a Marussia,
this new
yeah, from
generation.
A Marussia point of view, absolutely, because we didn't go testing last year,
which was
a damn good idea, and I'd recommend it to everyone. But no, seriously, we didn't go testing. We did do one test with the old car, of course, last year, and the tyres do seem to have been a bit more tricky. But no more tricky than they were in 2011. So, you know, the 2012 winter tyre was probably a little bit easier to use at the low temperatures. But, you know, it is probably 10... Well, I guess in Melbourne, looking at the weather at the moment, it's been really hot there, but I think looking at next week, it's sort of back to average. But that should still see track temperatures 40, 45 And I really do expect the tyres to work quite well at that sort of track temperature.
Was it Jean-Eric Vergne who described them as cauliflowers? Cauliflowers. I thought it was a really lovely graphic image.
Yes, I'd love to know how he arrives at that simile, though.
Yes. So, well, yeah. Well, it is a bit crumbly, the top of a cauliflower.
True,
it?
Yes.
It's a real shame it's not television, but by the way, because Pat, being an engineer, you know, has brought these rather impressive-looking blue and red graphs with him, which he's referring to. I don't... What are these graphs, Pat?
Well, these are really, as I say, clever people work out the our estimate of qualifying pace and race pace based on the data from last week. And I knew you'd ask me, so I thought, well, rather than sound a complete idiot, I'd only sound half an idiot, but at least having some data in front of me.
It's me who sounds like the idiot. It's my job, Pat. Okay. Let's move on, because Simon has very kindly jotted down some topics for us here. And this one I think is interesting. Is how soon would a Formula One team start working on a 2014 car and kind of give up on the 2013 car? What point does it depend on which team it is?
I'm sure it does. It's a very interesting question because, of course, it's a huge problem for all the teams, but for small teams like ours, it's extremely troublesome, and it really does keep me awake at night. To answer the first part of the question, I mean, even at Marussia, we started doing some CFD studies around last September. So, you know, fundamental things like the front wing width has changed and the rear beam wing has disappeared and the top rear wing is a little bit smaller. So we started looking at those fundamentals in CFD. We have already run what I'd call an interim car in the wind tunnel.
Really?
It's not the full model yet, but it's got dimensionally correct components, if you like, added to our current car. And we switched to full wind tunnel testing of that of the 2014 car in about 6 weeks or so from memory, 6 to 8 weeks, something like that. Now we will keep a 2013 model sitting in the model shop as fully assembled as we can, so that we can perhaps try and do a little bit of work on it, but very, very difficult. The task is enormous. It's much bigger than we've had for many years, but the time is no different, nor are the number of people. So even things like front impact test, you know, the one thing that's been quite nice with the current generation of Formula One cars with a very high nose is that it's quite a nice structure for a frontal impact. Whereas with the low noses, it's quite an offset load. So, for example, we're already working on that, and we're making dummy noses to start impact testing, even though we don't know what the final shape will be. So it's already taking I'd say by the time we're sort of into the first couple of races, at that point we'll have been more people working on 14 than 13.
Mm.
Which, of course, is not desirable when you're trying to fight for position. And, you know, I think in Marussia we will be fighting for position this year.
Well, and where are you with engines for 2014?
When I say we're working on it, there is a little bit of a gap between the rear bulkhead and the gearbox at the moment. That's true, and it does make life a little bit difficult. But, you know, the Formula One community is perhaps not as... mean as you might think, and we have had a little bit of assistance just helping us on things like cooling and what have you, but the target I set for having a 2014 engine contract signed was actually May 2012, so we're a long way past that without having an engine.
Pat, you've got Marussia's got a technical partnership with McLaren. Are you using McLaren's tunnel, or
are
you
yeah,
using
we it? Are.
So yep. And obviously they're going to be using that a lot during the course of the year for the same reason, because they've got a radical rule change to deal with for 2014. I mean, how much time are you going to be able to get in that? Will you get enough?
Well, lots of questions in there. But the first thing is that they're not using it. McLaren actually used Toyota tunnel, as do Ferrari. There are two tunnels at the old Toyota Formula One facility in Cologne. Ferrari use one, not quite full time, but pretty well there and McLaren the other. So there's plenty of time in the tunnel at McLaren, but you know, wind tunnel testing is a very expensive proposition. And at Marussia, as part of our arrangement with McLaren, they've actually been very good to us, and they've given us more tunnel time this year than we had last year, at the same sort of rolled-in cost of our contract. So I'm very, very pleased about that. But still, we are running sort of 2 weeks in four, and we run 80 hours a week. So you know, compared to the teams that are running 24/7, it really is quite difficult. What we do in a month, they do in a week in round numbers.
This is Man United in QPR, isn't it?
Something like Man United in Brentford, I think.
Sorry, that was a football reference.
I think if we look at QPR's owner, I think that their Formula One team's using an awful lot more wind tunnel time than we are. So, and I'm a Norwich supporter, as you well know.
Okay, fine. That's the last football reference we'll be making today. But the inequality is pretty spectacular, isn't it, between the front row and the back row?
Yeah, it is. In every respect, you know. I mean, they say it's tough at the top, and it is, but what they don't say is it's a hell of a lot tougher at the bottom. And, you know, this year, the new teams, as they are still referred to, no longer have the comfort of the column three money from Bernie. The new teams came in under the Concord agreement that has recently expired, and under that Concord agreement there was an amount of money set aside for the new teams, irrespective of where they were in the championship. If they moved up, then of course it got a lot more, which is why the 10th place is something that's been talked about a lot. But that's no longer there, so it does get even tougher. It really does.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's not the most welcome news either when Bernie says, "I want 20 cars." In other words,
well, I think if you're a Red Bull or Ferrari, you actually don't care when he says that. But if you're a Marussia or Caterham have you, and of course, you know, we say Marussia and Caterham, but you have to remember that. I think move outside the top four, actually I'd even say the top three, and I think every team is in, it's on tenterhooks for one reason or another, and outside the top four it's financial. Mm-hmm. And of course one of the things with a small team like Marussia is that because we're small, we're able to contain our costs. So, you know, if the money isn't there, we can pull our horns in a little bit. But if you have a big operation, Lotus at Enstone, for example, you know, it's very, very difficult because your overheads and your fixed costs are just enormous.
Pat, there are very, very few quite small changes between last year and this year as regards the regulations. Do you foresee a year similar to last year, or do you think that for example, the DRS change and the step nose, I mean, are they significant changes or not?
I think in the overall scheme of things, I'd say no, they're not significant. You know, significant is going to a V6 turbo with a spoonful of fuel to run it on. That's significant. These are, you know, they are evolutionary changes, and when you look at the cars, they are evolutionary as well. That's not to say there isn't some interesting innovation out there, and of course the passive DRS, which Lotus first sort of brought to the scene last year, is something a few people are working on, and a few people are sort of saying, well, actually, we're not even going to look at it because it is going to divert too much attention from the problem of getting a 2014 car going and doing the basic work on the 13. So there's still innovation out there, and there's still, you know, absolutely gorgeous detail in the aerodynamic subtleties of the cars. So that work continues. You know, while there's 24 hours in a day, 7 days in a week, and enough electricity to run a wind tunnel, those cars will evolve.
I read something about the Coanda effect, which I thought was a Le Carre novel, but apparently it's to do with what is it to do with? it's the exhaust gases and the downforce, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? It's a bit of a buzzword at the moment, of course, but it was named after a guy by the name of Henri Coanda, who was, I think, Romanian by birth, but spent most of his life in Belgium, and he was an aerodynamicist. Actually, he even produced some very novel aircraft, including what some people might regard as the first jet aircraft. It wasn't a jet engine, but it worked on reaction, which was very interesting. But among the many things he discovered as an aerodynamicist was this effect, which was named after him, which is really, it describes the propensity of a stream of fluid, be it air or liquid or exhaust gas, to adhere to a curved surface. And probably the best way to sort of illustrate this, although some might argue it's not fully Coanda effect, and it is true, but we won't get too technical now. But if you run a tap and you've got a stream of water falling from the tap into the sink, and you take a spoon and you introduce a sort of convex face of the spoon into that stream of water from the side, that water will tend to curl round the spoon and divert off to the side. Now, some people say that's not true Coanda effect because of surface tension and everything, but oh no, we're not going to get
technical. But for a family show.
It's a good illustration.
So, but just briefly, I mean, isn't that what Williams were doing, and it was very quickly protested? Have I got this right?
No, that was slightly different, because this effect really has been used for quite a while now. In fact, since the FIA required the exhaust outlets to be in a position where they hoped they wouldn't influence the aerodynamics. Of course, the aerodynamicist said, but Mr. Coanda knows different, and he did. So really, it's just about that. Now the sort of controversy over Williams and indeed Caterham was that when the FIA determined that the exhaust outlet had to be in a certain position, which they hoped would not influence aerodynamics, they also said that you can't have anything in the plume, which is the plume of exhaust gas coming out, which may divert that plume of exhaust gas or ingest it into an aerodynamic device or anything like that. And what both Williams and Caterham did was they very carefully placed a little, let's call it a turning vane, which was just sort of within the geometric regulations, but outside this sort of catch-all, which said you can't divert the air to and re-ingest it. So it was determined to be illegal.
Already.
Is there anyone still awake?
Sorry, we're with you. Let's move away from technology for a minute and talk about drivers, because I think, you know, people tend to find drivers slightly more exciting, or at least the non-technical of us. And Simon's given me a note here saying, you know, would you have signed Hülkenberg and not Perez had you been at McLaren? And it's something that quite a lot of people are talking about.
If I'd been at McLaren, yes, I would have gone the Hülkenberg route. I think he's a pretty good driver. Watched him, you know, for a long while, European Formula 3, same time as Vettel, I think, wasn't it? Yeah. And, you know, he was a good racer, good speed, but good ability to race. He's, I think, shown well in Formula 1 and occasionally extremely well. I think he's a great driver, and I think, you know, with the sort of scene that there was at that time, I think that would have been my first choice, yeah.
I mean, he's won at every level. It's so fragmented now on the southern slopes of the nursery formula that it's hard to tell who's good and who's not, but dominated Formula BMW, won the F3 Euro Series, having gone off to do A1GP in the meantime and blitzed that, won GP2 Series at the first attempt, scored 60-odd more points than his teammate Pastor Maldonado, who's in his third season. You know, he's got a fantastic track record. There's nothing about his junior record that says anything other than the fact he's a potential star.
No, that's right. And I agree with you. It's difficult sometimes to judge from the sort of junior record. It's not always the obvious ones who come to the front. But what I did like about him was, you know, I remember watching on TV some of the European F3 rounds and just thinking the guy was a racer. And I think he still is, you know, and we've seen a couple of occasions of that, particularly in Brazil, haven't we?
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we all like that, don't we?
Yeah.
The more the merrier. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was much easier identifying junior talents when they're all in Pat Simmons' Royal RP24s, wasn't it, or RP26s?
Okay.
Pat, when I was talking to Anthony Davidson, we were doing the preview for the season for the magazine, and that was before the first test, before Harith, and I said, right, if you're betting now, who's going to be world champion this year? And he immediately said Vettel. And I said, why? And he said, because they've still got the blown floor, and I just think Red Bull will always make a better job of that than their opposition, and Vettel has got a handle on how to drive a blown floor car, you know, certainly better than Mark.
There's something in that. You know, the subtleties of these blown floors are pretty intriguing. You know, we're just getting into it at Marussia. We're a bit behind on these things because, you know, it takes us a little bit longer. But, you know, a lot has to come from the engine manufacturer to get the exhaust blowing effect. And, of course, the other three, not Cosworth, the other three have been at this for a while now. And Cosworth have actually done a super job for us over the winter. Really, really impressive. You know, again, working on a shoestring. But they really have, I think, caught up a little way, and it's up to us to exploit that. But, yeah, along the way, you have to learn the tricks of the trade, both as an engineer, how to exploit the exhaust effect as best you can, and as a driver. And of course, it was interesting actually at Jerez. I wandered up to the chicane just to listen to the cars. I'm not a great believer in watching cars. You know, people watch them and say, "Oh yeah, it was understeering here and oversteering there." Well, actually, the way the tyres were in Jerez, you could actually see that. But generally speaking, I think it's very hard to tell that. Well, you can tell a bit about the precision of the driver and everything, but what you can do is you can listen. And you can listen to when people can get on the power, and you can listen to what's going on under braking. And it was very, very interesting. You know, the technique now is really to try and leave all your shifting to the end, and, you know, there's several reasons for that, to keep the exhaust gases flowing. So has Vettel learned that better than Webber? I'm not convinced of that, because I think it's very interesting when the blown floors first came along, I think it was Webber who exploited them first, because he realised that actually there was a way of using a different line, which allowed you to maybe go in a little bit slower but get on the power earlier, and therefore get the blown effect, the full blown effect, rather than just the overrun effect, which is the other area people are working on. So, you know, I think Vettel's just a damn good driver. I don't think that it's necessarily that he's learnt how to exploit that particular effect better. But I disagree even further, because I think Alonso's going to be champion.
Well, yeah, I do too. And actually, at the Hall of Fame, I was talking to Stefano Domenicali, and he said, quite, I think he was being lighthearted, but he was sort of half serious. He said, actually, the danger with having Alonso is that is shaking from your mind, well, if we get the car sort of fairly close, you know, he'll do the rest. And he said, and of course, you can't think like that. You know, we've got to think in terms of giving him a better car. But he said, I just think the guy is so good that that is a trap you can start to slide into if you're not careful.
Yeah.
I bet you never thought that was Schumacher and Alonso, did you?
No, I didn't. I think, you know.
No. What
you did know with him was that if you were having an off day, and, you know, championship teams have off days, 2005, 2006 with Fernando, we had days that were not as good as others. What you did know with him was that he would, he'd find that little bit extra that, you know, that brought you back up to a good level of competitiveness again. I can imagine Stefano saying that, but I can't imagine Pat Fry saying it.
No. I'm saying he was grinning when he said it. Neil, I mean, he obviously, he knew he wasn't making a serious point, but he just said, he said, when you've got a driver that good, it's always in your head that you sort of, well, we've got an advantage to start with.
Yeah, so, it is true. And I well remember in the days when we were talking initially about resource restrictions, you know, and trying to limit the spend in
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Formula One. And, of course, Flavio Briatore, who was my boss then, was saying, oh, well, you don't want all this technology, it's far too expensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And several people pointed out to him that, of course, he'd decided to spend an awful lot of money on the driver to find 3/10, which is quite true.
Well, we're on drivers, let's talk about Max Chilton, seeing as Marussia, et cetera. We have to assume that the bulk of the people listening do make these connections, otherwise we'll spend all afternoon explaining them. In my view, he's received rather a lot of unnecessarily mean press, actually. I mean, okay, he's paying for his drive. This is hardly anything new. I mean, it's not something that suddenly happened in motor racing. Tell us what you would think about him so far.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there's been a lot of slating of the pay drivers, but, you know, they are a fact of life, whether you regard it as unfortunate or fortunate. I think we'd all love to see, you know, something like athletics, where, you know, just pure talent will always come to the fore. But that's not the way it is in motorsport, and I don't really know whether you can ever change that. You know, even going back to basics, I spent many years in Formula Ford, and certainly if you had a bit of money, and if your dad was prepared to put some money in, you were more successful than the kid who wasn't. And I can look back in those days and I can think of people like Terry Gray, for example, who was a damn good Formula Ford driver who I certainly thought would go all the way, but he dropped out because he didn't have the money. And there were others who I think, you know, managed to reach their own level of incompetence quite quickly. So there's nothing new in it. I think it is a little bit unfair that these guys are getting slated, because, you know, Max is a competent driver. He has gone through, you know, the junior formulas with some credit, and he deserves his place in Formula One as much as many. Now, does that mean that there isn't some kid out there who deserves it more? I don't know, and I don't think we ever will know.
Yes, but
the answer's probably yes. Statistically, the answer must be yes, mustn't it?
I think in Max's case, he got pushed a long way forward very quickly because there was the wherewithal there to do it. But my belief is that in 2012, he sort of caught himself up, and last year in GP2, his racecraft, which had arguably been one of his weaker points hitherto, was great. And he was, you know, if he qualified third or fourth, he'd race for third or fourth. He wouldn't slip backwards, and you know, he controlled a couple of races, difficult tracks, Budapest, Singapore, where he scored his two wins. Yeah, using tyre strategy, he was very good.
I agree. I mean, Singapore, I think he was outstanding that weekend, and that is not an easy circuit. You know, it's so easy to drop it there. And of course, in GP2, it does seem that to win the championship, you need to sit there for 3 years. And
unless you
go
Hülkenberg,
yeah,
or Lewis Hamilton.
So these days, so Max has done pretty well, I think. You know,
how much has your sort of your optimism for the year ahead increased since Bianchi
came aboard? I am reasonably optimistic for the year. You know, the whole sort of ethos of Marussia is to have steady growth towards respectability, albeit on about 2 and 6 months. But you know, we will try our hardest to do that. And I think that, well, let's see in Australia. But I'm certainly hoping that when you compare qualifying times in Melbourne this year with qualifying times in Melbourne last year, I think you'll find that Marussia stand out in a class of their own for improvement.
How is it for you on a personal level? I mean, you've chased world titles with Michael Schumacher and Benetton. You've chased world titles successfully again with Fernando Alonso and Renault. How is it for you now when you're, I mean, your realistic goal is kind of beating Caterham to 10th place in the Constructors' Championship, to kind of get yourself motivated for that?
It's no different at all. I think the job is harder. In many ways, it's more interesting. And, the sort of the fight is definitely, I think it's stronger than ever.
And what of Mr. Bianchi and what you've seen so far?
Well, I tell you what, I've never seen anything happen so fast. It was absolutely incredible. And I'm not exaggerating that, you know, from beginning to end, that was about 24 hours. When Rozier was unable to take the seat for financial reasons, and, you know, we had no option over that, we were sort of casting around for what was going on. There were names in the frame, there were names with money, there were names that would drive for free who were pretty experienced. The Bianchi thing really only arose when he didn't get the Force India seat. And I don't think I was alone in sort of almost thinking that was a fait accompli. I just thought that was what was going to happen. It seemed to fit into the big picture of Force India changing to Ferrari engines, etc., etc., etc. So all of a sudden he was free, and all of a sudden we had a free seat. Now, 2 and 2 doesn't always make 4, but in this particular case, there was a quick phone call to Andrei Cheglikov, who's the owner of Marussia, and he said, "No, that's what we should do." And we said, "Well, that means we're going to have even less money than we thought we had." And he said, "Yep, so you're just going to have to try harder, aren't you?" So, and that's the way it ended up. And honestly, that whole deal was done in about 24 hours. We did the seat fit in Barcelona on Friday night. He went out on Saturday, and I have to say, he thoroughly impressed me. Now, of course, he's not a total rookie. You know, he'd done his Friday sessions with Force India and everything, and it showed, you know, because he was straight into the procedures and all this sort of stuff. I'm impressed, and I think he's just what we needed in the team. He'll push Max will push him. Very pleased about it.
Pat, this being something of a history magazine, apart obviously from its contemporary content, we tend to get questions that take us right back in time. Are you ready for this?
I doubt it.
I'm not, I'll tell you that. It comes from Cameron McCauley, who's one of our listeners, readers, and he wants to know from you what features made the Tolman 183 so fast at the Rio test that it forced the other teams to copy you.
Oh, I do love this question.
Good. Do you know what? I am so pleased you love it.
I mean, this was really was one of the greatest times of my career, because, you know, for, I guess we have to fill in a little bit of the history without going on too long, but in Tolman had come into Formula One in 81, qualified I think only twice in the entire season, with a car that was known as the General Bolgrano or the Flying Pig. There was not much affection for the car, let's put it that way. That car carried on into 82, where it qualified, it raced, but it only once did it even look vaguely like it was going to get a point.
It got the fastest lap at Brands Hatch, didn't it?
It did get the fastest lap at Brands Hatch, which could be a whole other podcast.
In novel circumstances.
Anyway, quickly changing the subject. For 83, there was an entirely new set of rules. The ground effect cars were outlawed, and it was the first generation of the flat bottom cars. You know, essentially, we still have flat bottom cars today, albeit slightly differently. And Rory Byrne and myself were sort of looking after Tolman Design at that time. And we really just sort of looked at the rules and just applied an awful lot of lateral thinking. And we produced a car that had just oodles more downforce than any of its contemporaries. A very odd-looking car, but it exploited every little loophole in the rules. And of course, life was very different then to the way it is now, because if you do anything like that now, you have a load of lawyers from the other teams who are inspecting your car, whereas in those days, you know, the other chief designers and technical directors, or whatever we called ourselves in those days, would come along and say, "Bloody hell, that's a good idea. Yeah, I really like that. Well done." And then next week they'd have the same thing on the car.
So it was really simple.
It was great fun. And it was a supercar. It was very, very fast in Rio. Now, the other thing you have to remember is that in those days we used to test for 2 weeks solid in Rio before the race. Now, the 183, as that car was known, was a very, very difficult car to set up. When you got it right, stunningly fast. Now, 2 weeks of testing, you get it right. But after that, it was a very tricky car. When we got it working, when we got it set up right, it flew. But its sweet spot was absolutely tiny. But I love that question. That's really good.
And thank you very much, Cameron McCauley, for making Pat Simmons grin like a Cheshire cat. But actually, I don't think you told us what you did to the car.
Well, it was the...
You said you added loads of downforce.
Yeah, by exploiting the rules, by really a lot of lateral thinking. You know, the cars in those days were pretty conventional. They had side pods, they had little wings on the front, they had a slightly bigger wing on the rear, and that was it. This thing had a full-width front diffuser. It had an enormous 140 centimetre wide wing over the engine, because there was a little bit of the rules there that they'd forgotten to cover. It was just a great car.
He's still grinning. I love it. Okay, we do take our readers' questions for obvious reasons, and the next one comes from Martin Robinson, and it's back to the drivers, and a lot of people often ask this, but we will ask it this time. He wants to know really whether who was better, Alonso or Schumacher. Is it possible to answer this question or not? It's not really, is it?
The short answer is no, and I guess I've been asked it so many times. And Senna, of course, now I work with him, and I'm often asked to compare them. And because they're basically a decade apart, each one, it's very hard, because what's required of the drivers is different. But the thing that they all had was this sort of incredible drive, you know, this incredible self-belief. Where was it strongest? I don't know. I have to say that with Michael, he was probably the first driver who really understood about attention to detail, and of course that's a given now in terms of fitness.
Well, you think over and above people like Senna and Prost?
Oh yeah,
that's interesting.
I mean, Senna, absolutely. It wasn't until much later in his career that he really started to think about these things. If you remember when he drove for us at Tolman, you know, the guy was so unfit. He first race he collapsed.
Kyle Army, I remember, he had to be lifted out of the car,
exactly.
Didn't he? Yeah.
Now, you know, that would never happen with Michael. Before he got in a Formula One car, he was going to be fitter than anyone else. And that means that, you know, you can drive that car at 10/10 all the time. So, you know, there's certainly a tick of respect for Michael in that aspect, that attention to detail. But so hard to answer the question. They're all, you know, on a plane above the others, and that makes it very difficult to judge.
Can I just a little Senna thing? Everyone always says, you know, 1984 Monaco Grand Prix, if the checkered flag hadn't come out, Senna was going to win. But I believe that he'd actually tweaked the suspension, and the team's view was he probably wouldn't have finished that race. So the fact, you know, I know it's hypothetical, but in all likelihood, he wouldn't have won.
Well, now, it is hypothetical, but you see, when you say in all likelihood, that's a sort of, you're starting to put statistics into it then, so are we talking balance of probability or what?
That'll do, balance of probability is fine.
The fact is that, yeah, he had clouted the curb a little bit hard, and one of the front rockers had a crack in it, which we found after the race. I honestly don't know whether it would have finished the race or not. I mean, the loading was quite low, obviously it was wet, but another clambering over the curbs might have been one too many for it, that's for sure.
One more question from our readers. This comes from Steve and Jane. I don't get many ladies asking questions on this podcast. Anyway, we have now. And Steve and Jane want to know whether the new regulations for 2014 will allow people like you to be more innovative, give you a bit more freedom, or are we still going to be very, very prescriptive with the new cars?
No, I think unfortunately, you know, it's interesting. We were just talking about a major change of rules in allowed the tollman in 83 to really just completely move from the back of the grid to the front of the grid. And it's rather a romantic notion that that could happen again. But unfortunately, life's so different now. You know, that was in a time when a total team was 60 people, you know, that's designing the car, building the car, racing the car, and therefore, you know, you could think out of the box and you could maybe outwit other people. But when you're, you know, you're trying to, as a small team, I mean. But now, a small team, Marussia is 130 odd people, trying to compete against teams that are 650 people. There's just so much, again, it's this attention to detail and you know, the absolute groundwork that's done on everything. It's no longer engineering intuition, it's pure science. And science requires monkeys operating computers and things, you know. It's a lovely romantic notion to think that it could turn the grid upside down, but I'm afraid I doubt it will. In fact, it can do the opposite.
Isn't there the slightest ray of hope that some engineering genius will come up with some blindingly great idea that...
Yes, there is. Let's not kill the idea stone dead. But equally, remember that I've actually got a set of the 1983 technical regulations, and I can't remember how many pages it is now. But it's very, very few. You know, very few. The bodywork regulations. You know, it's sort of like a few paragraphs. Whereas now, crikey, Article 3 just goes on and on and on, and the entire technical regulations, well over 100 pages, and there's an appendix of about 80 pages, and there's technical directives which run into the hundreds of pages which you have to add to it. So everything's a lot tighter now than it was then. Everything's more prescriptive. So again, you know, it just makes it that much harder to really make a breakthrough. And unfortunately, also, you get the philosophy change. Now, as I said, in 83, Patrick Head looked at our car and said, that's a damn good idea, ours will be like that in Long Beach, and it was. These days, as I say, you know, it's lawyers, it's frequent trips to Paris, which I know all about, and
it's a bit like life itself, really.
I mean, well, from your point of view, doing what you do, was it more fun? Was it more satisfying, less satisfying?
No, I don't think it was. It was probably more fun because life was more fun then, you know. Or maybe it was just I was 30 years younger. I hadn't thought of that little fact. You know? But no, I think, you know, I am a professional engineer and I'm an academic. And I used to sometimes find it very frustrating that we couldn't use science in those days. And I do enjoy the fact that, you know, it is real engineering these days. In fact, it's real leading edge engineering. So as an engineer, I'd say it's much more fun now. Racing was probably more fun then.
Pat, I mean, we don't know how you would impose a budget cap, but if you could impose a budget cap, would you fancy the idea of saying that, right, you've got that to spend, here are the regulations, this wide, this high, this weight, this long, that's it? If it runs on gravy, it doesn't matter.
I like it. The only thing that you've always got to think of unintended consequences. For the 2009 regulations, myself, Rory Byrne and Paddy Lowe wrote most of the bodywork regulations, the aerodynamics, and it was a great lesson in unintended consequences, because we left little areas where we thought, you know, people should work on this, work on that, and boy, did they grow. And there were certainly things that, you know, we hadn't thought of at the time. There always will be. And if you do have a budget cap and then very free rules, you'll certainly get some innovation, you'll get some great ideas and everything. The trouble is that, what do you want? Do you want innovation? Do you want cars that look interesting? Or do you want good racing? And I think the answer is most people want good racing. And I think the engineers actually, I'm going to be shot for this, but I think they have far too much say in what's done. So if we had this sort of nirvana of a budget cap and a very loose set of regulations, there is no doubt that someone will get it right, someone will get it wrong, and there'll be intermediate steps along the way. Now, if the budget cap is a sensible budget cap, it means you're not going to have the money to sort of say, oh God, we got it wrong, that's the way to do it, let's do it all again. You can't, you've run out of money, and therefore you've locked in that performance for a year or so. And that doesn't lead to good racing. What leads to good racing is not having rules that change very often until we all sort of gravitate towards this sort of single point of excellence, or as close as we can get to it, and the cars become more equal, and then you get good racing.
We sure have got good racing, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. You know, we've had relatively stable rules. We do have, we've got great tyres for racing, because it allows the different performance profile. And that's something we'll see in 2014 that I think will make the racing good. We'll see, because you have limited energy, you know, you don't really have as much energy as you want to race all the time. People will use it in different ways, so you'll get a different performance profile. You know, someone will choose to go fast at the beginning of the race, slower at the end.
This is because of the smaller fuel tank.
Pat, I mean, that was what the Rosbergs and the Burgers, nobody hated about. That was the only thing they hated about the last turbo era, the very idea of, you know,
fuel saving.
The difference,
having,
I think,
to
Nigel,
cruise when you wanted to race.
Yeah, but it's what we do at the moment. Yeah, we don't put in the full amount of fuel.
No, that's perfectly true.
And the big difference is, I think, you know, with Keke's time and Gerhard's time, was that it wasn't a very exact science, you know, and there was a danger of running out of fuel and things like that. You know, cars don't run out of fuel anymore, and they won't do in 2014, because we can manage the situation so well.
Yeah. I just think for a lot of people, you know, a lot of fans, the whole idea of fuel economy figuring in motor racing is, you know, anathema. And I understand their point of view.
Yeah.
People have been writing to say, God almighty, why does Formula One have to be green, for Christ's sake? The energy it uses, da-da-da-da, the energy that gets used is people driving to the racetrack to watch them.
Well, what about the jumbo jet that takes them there?
Well, or the single flight across the Atlantic.
I have a theory about this, because I think we're negative, because we have a lot of people sit at home and watch us on TV rather than go out and drive their cars. That's got to be good, hasn't it?
Well, that's true. Yes, there is that. Yeah.
Lateral thinking.
I think it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I'm certainly interested in 2014 rules as an engineer, and I think when you see a little bit about the engines, I think you'll be stunned, because the efficiency of them is beyond belief. And I think very few people realise that our current Formula One engines are actually pretty damn efficient, because power is efficiency. You know, we've always sort of struggled to find power, but we find it through efficiency. And now we've turned that round and we're looking for efficiency even more. And they are incredibly impressive. Did we need to do it? Well, I think now, as a team on a low budget, you know, it worries the hell out of me, because these are expensive engines and it is going to be difficult for us to find the money to run these engines. But equally, you know, you just never know where these things are going to go. And I thought, and I still think, that it was important that we were never seen to be socially unacceptable in motorsport. And I think if we'd done nothing, there would have been a faction that would have said, this is wrong, you know, this is harming the planet, this is not good.
And it's out of step with
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's a bit like, you know, you wouldn't walk down King's Road wearing a fur coat now, would you?
No.
Well,
I wouldn't.
No, I certainly wouldn't. But,
yeah, that's a good point.
That's
good point.
Yeah, that's quite right.
Can we, we're running out of time, but maybe we could just take Bruce Dewar's question here because it's relevant. And he's saying that might we see flywheel cars because of the much smaller fuel tank in 2014? I mean, at the moment, when the fuel tank was increased in size post-2009, it was battery cars.
Yeah, and the rules are completely positioned for batteries again. Now, the flywheel cars is an interesting proposition. The energy density, in other words, you know, the amount of energy you can store for a given amount of weight, is pretty damn good on these flywheels. And you know, John Hilton at Flybrid, who's doing these systems now for road cars and Le Mans cars and everything, has done some incredible work. They really are a very, very acceptable way of storing regenerated energy, but the F1 rules have not gone in that direction. They've been directed at battery electrical systems.
There's your answer, Bruce. Okay, I think we're just about out of time. I'm afraid it's gone very quickly, hasn't it?
It's
pure joy, actually, having an engineer here who's able to speak to ordinary people and make it so understandable. Thank you very, very much.
Engineers are ordinary people as well, you know.
Are they? Just before we go, now I need to tell everybody about our new subscription offer, but just glancing at these graphs here, which I've been sort of looking at occasionally, would you like to make some sort of prediction? I know you hate this sort of thing, but the top three in Melbourne from what you've seen in Spain?
Well, I won't put them in order, but I think the top three, I'm going to go, I think I have to go Vettel, Alonso and Hamilton.
Okay, Vettel, Alonso and Hamilton, but not necessarily in that order. Mr. Aaron?
I haven't really thought about it. Australia's always a funny race because at the start of the season they're all race rusty, funny things happen and you do get peculiar people popping
What's
up at the top
answer?
End of the order. But the answer, I will say Vettel, Alonso. Mark Webber's got to finish on the podium in Australia 1 year, so yeah, Vettel, Alonso, Webber.
Yeah, that's pretty good actually. I'd be very tempted to go with that. Certainly Vettel and Alonso, and I'll split the difference here and say, you know, either Lewis or Mark. They should be. One of them should be on the podium
as well.
Nigel. Well, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think of logically, you think, well, McLaren, you know, and you just never know with McLaren. The thing may go to Melbourne and fly.
Mm. I think a lot will depend on temperatures as well.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about how difficult it was earlier, and of course, one thing, if you remember from last year, was the Mercedes was always good when it was cold.
The wind in China, cold conditions,
the winter testing, and various other times.
Yeah. Of course, there are so many parameters, but readers of motorsport like to talk about this down the pub. You know,
One thing I think is that a lot of people have been reckoning that the Lewis is going to bury Nico this year, and I don't think he is. I'm not saying for a second Nico's going to have the beating of Lewis all the time, but I don't think it's going to be anything like as clear-cut as a lot of people think.
Am I allowed to... I've got time to butt in and say that I've never particularly been convinced by Nico Rosberg.
You have butted in, and that's absolutely fine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just... You know, he went well in Formula BMW, fine, but again, as I was saying earlier, fragmented junior categories, it's very hard to draw conclusions. Formula 3, he didn't do that well. He was an occasional race winner, front runner, but he wasn't anything special. GP2, ART had a very clear performance advantage. And in F1, he was 0.4 slower than Mark Webber in 2006. And the Mercedes guys say that from mid-2011 onwards, Schumacher was their best race bet.
We look forward to having the encyclopedia back on this podcast, don't we, Pat?
There we are.
This is wonderful stuff. I love it. How you store all this information, I have no idea.
And the bits I mentioned, he was racing against Kazuki Nakajima and Alex Wurz, which wasn't really a benchmark.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Simon. Thank you very much. And thank you very, very much indeed, Pat. Quickly, to tell you about our new subscription offer, you can save up to £30 against the standard cover price by taking out a subscription to Motorsport Magazine right now. And all new subscribers will receive a free 300-piece jigsaw depicting Graham Hill leading his rivals through Eau Rouge, oh yeah, during the 1965 Belgian Grand Prix. To take advantage of this offer, visit motorsportmagazine.com/JS13 or call us on 0207 349 8472. Or toll-free from America, this goes on and on 1-866-808-5828, quoting JS13. If you take out a subscription to our great magazine right now, you can save up to £30 and get a fantastic motor racing jigsaw. That sums it up, doesn't it? Thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.